Okay, so as I promised, on Wednesday, I want to tell you a bit about the hierarchy problem today. Just review it. I think this will likely be familiar to many people, but it's the kind of thing that we often talk about in a kind of sloppy way. And then that'll lead us, as one motivation, start talking a bit about supersymmetry and its status, and then this afternoon I'll get into the collider physics, I hope, a little bit more. So the way that we usually talk about the hierarchy problem in the standard model is that the top enters in loops, loop corrections to the Higgs mass, and that when you calculate these loop corrections, they're quadratically divergent. So I don't want to work in the standard model. It's a crazy theory, as we discussed. It's also a lot more complicated than you need to consider many things. So I'm just going to work in a toy standard model where we don't have any of the gauge symmetries, but we are going to put in some coupling to a left and right of a Higgs, left and right-handed top quarks. And of course, everybody has a mass. So when you do that, so I just have one T here, one fermion, one Dirac fermion T that gets its mass from the Higgs, obviously, also some B of H that gives H of M. And in this case, what you'll find very concretely is that the correction to the Higgs mass squared is going to look like an integral d4L if L is the loop momentum of this top quark here. And you'll have some fermion trace. So that'll give you a L slash plus M top squared over top squared squared. Couplings, Y squared, and an important minus one because we have a fermion trace. So I can combine that, do the integral, well, do the trace, and what you'll find is that the trace gives you two terms, gives you an L squared plus M top squared over L squared minus M top squared squared. And now I can do this integral with a cutoff regulator if I want to. Get an extra factor of two from my traces. If I do this integral with a cutoff regulator, I'm clearly going to get something that goes like y squared lambda squared plus other corrections, just by power counting of the L's at a high momentum. Okay, well, what does that mean? Oh, and if I'm keeping track, I'll keep track of my minus sign. What does that mean? I mean, this is some fairly unphysical regulator, and many people have pointed out, well, if you were to do this integral in dimensional regularization, you're not going to get a cutoff squared. So is it really there? Does it really mean anything? If you take it too literally, indeed it doesn't mean anything. But what it is a sign of is it's a sign of UV sensitivity of this calculation. So yes, it's true that if I were to do it in 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, I would get some explicit thing with no lambdas, sorry, with no cutoffs. I'd get some y squared, m top squared over 8 pi squared. I think I actually got all the signs right on this. Okay, no lambda. But cut off squared and the expression is still a sign that this whole problem is UV sensitive. So suppose I add to my toy Lagrangian. Some heavy stuff, some heavy scalars. So I'm going to add just say one scalar. Again, coupled to my Higgs. This is a simple example. I could add a heavy fermion. If I added a heavy fermion, well, you know what I would get, right? Exactly the same formula, but with m top replaced by the mass of my really heavy fermion. If I add a heavy scalar, then I'm going to get a contribution. That's the Higgs squared. Coming from this kind of loop here, and that would also be cutoff dependent in a cutoff regulation scheme. But more importantly, in dim reg, it would give me something that looks like mass of the scalar squared over 16 pi squared times lambda. Okay, with its own combination of finite and divergent pieces that I need to regulate over. Notice that here, as I drag the scalar mass up, the finite contribution is getting bigger. Right? So you can contrast that with, say, a scalar's contribution to G minus 2 of the muon, which is something that also, you know, you have to be careful doing the calculation. But if you calculate the contribution of the scalar to G minus 2 of the muon, it's going to go like the muon Yukawa squared times m muon squared over m scalar squared. The heavy scalar actually decouples. Or you could contrast it if you were to couple the scalar to the top quark. Then the correction to the top quark mass would go like delta m top is proportional to m top times some stuff. Okay, and that's because fermion masses can be protected by a chiral symmetry. Whereas the scalar mass is not. Okay, so concretely what this means is that if I'm an effective field theorist and I want to match my theory of nature, of toy nature, at a high scale with S to a low energy theory, right? I should be able to describe this much below the mass of S in a low energy theory with just some parameter MH star controlling the Higgs mass. Well, that MH star squared is going to have to be equal to whatever my MH squared is in the high energy theory, minus this correction coming from integrating out S. Okay, and I'm just putting this order here because I'm not being careful about exactly how I'm matching or at what scale. Yeah.
What's the formalized to epsilon?
So what I mean is that I'm doing dimensional regularization in 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions.
Okay.
Just to be clear about whether I'm doing 4 minus epsilon or 4 minus 2 epsilon or however one wants to write the regularization. So you would need some fine cancellation if this MS is much larger. Well, naively, what you'd expect is that in this theory, no matter what mh squared is, mh star squared, the low energy effective mass squared, should be at least the size of ms times some small couplings. Possibly bigger if that bare parameter was larger, but not smaller unless you had some really fine cancellation between the two. Now, of course, this argument did rely on saying that there's UV structure in the theory, okay? So if I only care about the standard model, and I believed that that was a complete theory of nature, then then I would have this dim reg argument. Except for two things. Number one, we know the standard model is not a complete theory of nature because we have evidence for new physics at high energies. We have evidence for gauge coupling unification. We have evidence for neutrino masses. We have evidence for gravity getting strong. So there has to be some new physics at high energies. We know it's not a complete theory of everything. Also, if the standard model is the complete theory of nature, then the complete theory of nature isn't UV finite. It still has these, it still has divergences, it still has these epsilons in it, right? So you have to think that if there exists a complete theory of nature, then you should be able to, you know, you should be able to calculate stuff in it. And that means that there must be something else in the theory such that when you do the full theory calculation of the Higgs mass, there's no epsilon in it. So one example of how you could do that, of how you could write down a theory with no epsilons in it, would be if I say, actually, I have my top quark contribution, but I also have this. And for whatever reason, lambda times the number of scalars in my theory was equal to y squared. Okay? That's actually how we do it in supersymmetric theories. In that case, the epsilons would cancel, and we can sensibly talk about what the correction to the mass of the Higgs is in that theory. All right, that's just one example. But the expectation is really pretty generic, that if you're adding something to the theory, then you're adding that something at some scale. If you're adding it at a low scale, then we should see it. If you're adding it at a high scale, then there's no reason it wouldn't also give finite corrections to the Higgs mass associated with that same scale. And the minute you're adding finite corrections associated to that scale, you're back with this concrete problem.
When we cancel the epsilon can cancel by counter term of renormalization. When we're adding new theory to cancel it, epsilon.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Yes, yeah, the epsilon can be canceled in a renormalization procedure by common terms, right?
Well, right, but I mean, but then you're talking about. I'm just saying that's not a. I mean, that's not a calculation. That's a procedure for dealing with a divergence, right?
The theory still is renormalizable, right, and therefore predictive. So why would we worry about?
Well, in what sense is it predictive? I mean, so you mean just the pure standard model up to?
Like, once we've measured the Higgs mass, we can go on with the rest.
Once you've measured the Higgs mass, you can go on with the rest. So I do agree with that. That this is I wouldn't call it predictive, but I would certainly agree, and I was planning to emphasize this next, that it's not a consistency problem, it's not an empirical problem. It's a predictivity problem. And I do think it is a real predictivity problem. I mean, measuring the Higgs mass is not predicting the Higgs mass. If you ask the question, is it conceivable that there is a UV complete theory where, you know, where the Higgs mass is predicted from your full theory of nature? Then the answer is yes, but it has to fall into one of two categories. Right? Either it's predicted, and the way you regulate the divergences we see in the low energy theory is by adding some light stuff, or it's predictive, and the way you regulate them is by adding some heavy stuff. But you do have to add stuff in order to get a theory without divergences. Yeah.
Don't you just kind of shift the problem though if you add something else, and then that something else is going to require new parameters, so you skip having to put in the Higgs mass, but instead you need to put in other stuff?
Good. So you're always going to have, I mean, As far as anybody's been able to come up with, every theory has parameters, right? But there are parameters that you can imagine the theory is defined at some scale, and you work your way down, right? And everything is calculable in, I mean, somehow nature knows how to calculate everything. right? It would seem. Nobody says that we have to be as smart as nature, right? But somehow, nature has a prescription for calculating everything in terms of whatever the fundamental rules are, right? And we're just picking up the scraps trying to figure out what those rules are. It's certainly true that there are parameters in the theory, as far as we can tell. There's no unified theory that predicts every one of these masses. And I think, personally, I think that dream is probably a little ludicrous, that one would find a theory with no parameters to explain everything we see.
Oh, but there's also the issue of whether you're seeing the parameters, whether the parameters make you wonder if there's any additional structure
right.
or not.
There's parameters, and then there's parameters that look like they just don't make sense by dimensional analysis. Right, in any consistent picture. Or that only makes sense by dimensional analysis in consistent pictures that involve new physics at low energy scales, which is the case here. Right? So yeah. So I'm not trying to say there should be a theory without parameters that somehow is going to when we talk about predicting the Higgs mass, all I really mean is a theory that can explain why the Higgs mass is roughly the scale that it is, in terms of its own natural parameters. Whatever those may be, through some sequence of dynamics, but not 32 decimal place cancellations of two parameters that just happen to be what they are. So this is a situation, if you just had this heavy scalar in your theory, where you would need, if your fundamental parameters are this mh squared and this, and that scalar's at the gut scale, then you need 30 decimal place cancellations to explain what that mh star squared is, what the low energy parameter that we've measured is. I suppose you can call that a prediction if you want to, but I think it's a bit of an abusive language. So there was one more point I wanted to make before that, which is, if the something you're adding is at a sort of intermediate scale, then you're in this odd situation where you've got a little bit of both problems, right? You're explaining most of the way how the Higgs mass scale arises, but you still need to invoke some amount of cancellation between these. So this is something that is becoming a big issue in thinking about natural solutions of the hierarchy problem, things like supersymmetry and other models too, so-called little hierarchy problems. So it used to be that we could invoke this and then say, oh, maybe the mass of the scalar that cancels the top divergence is 200 GeV. And then that would do a pretty good job of explaining this. Now, we know that the scalar, at least in simple models, the scalar that cancels the top divergence has to be up around 800 or 900 GeV or heavier, and that limit's going to continue going up unless the LHC finds something soon. So you're already running into a bit of a tuning in that scenario to explain the Higgs mass. All right, so in general, the LHC results for simple theories are pushing this level, this kind of cancellation, into the few percent level for most of the simple theories. And then for certain models that are probably a little more baroque, you can maybe get to 10 or 20%. But the weak scale has been sufficiently well explored that there does seem to be some level of cancellation involved in explaining the Higgs mass. So there's this question, at what point does the absence of evidence for some natural solution of the hierarchy problem become evidence for fine-tuning? Now, there is this sort of sense, I think, that we've now reached a point where one can one can take several different philosophical perspectives on this problem. Okay, and I'm not going to argue that any one is infinitely more reasonable than the others. So I think of it as a big triangle in personal scientific philosophy space. So this point of the triangle represents being dead convinced that there's some natural theory around the corner. And the great thing about that piece of the triangle is that at least if you draw a line in the sand of what you mean by around the corner, that is an invariant, largely an invariantly testable hypothesis. Okay, so this is the corner on which the most progress can be made, and has been made. In fact, the whole reason I'm drawing the triangle is that the entire field used to live way up here, and then LEP encroached on it, and the Tevatron encroached on it, and now the LHC has encroached on it. And now, if you want to live near that corner, fine, but you've got to accept that you're not right at the vertex of the triangle anymore. This corner is saying, well, maybe we're thinking about the problem wrong, okay? Maybe this hierarchy problem is just asking the wrong question. And I mean, to some extent, this is the most defensible version of this, the most precise version of this, is just to say, look, it's not an empirical problem, it's not a consistency problem. How do we know that asking this, what if I told you that, if God told me in a dream that he exists, and B, really you should think of the world as an S-matrix theory, right? Then it's not clear to me. And that, this whole picture, RG evolution, it was a good human tool for making sense of the S-matrix of nature. But I don't particularly think in terms of high energy scales and rundown. So, if you want to be wise like me, you shouldn't either. Then this is probably the wrong question, okay? There have been many other attempts to find ways of sort of evading the hierarchy problem by rewriting the rules. I don't find any of them very satisfying, so I personally tend to live closer to this edge of the triangle at any given time. Except for this fact that it's really not, it's really not a concrete problem. So the last edge of the triangle is, we're thinking about it right. There's a fine tuning, and it just is. It may not be a very good prediction, it may be an abusive language, but that's how nature works. Okay, and this is often accompanied by the possibility that that maybe there's some sort of anthropic selection of our parameters that comes, that's responsible for this. And I find it telling that you can invoke that anthropic rationale based on one of two hypotheses. The first hypothesis, the first of which is that, that there's a, since I'm already talking about God, I'm just going to go for it, that there's a benevolent creator who created the universe for us and really worked hard to make the parameters just right for us. And then the other possibility, which, popes have written encyclicals against, is that it's just a multiverse and we're completely random. And there's no scientific distinction between these two possibilities, as far as I can tell.
Is there anything to say about non-perturbative solutions to this problem?
Non-perturbative solutions to the
hierarchy problem. Did you do that two-point function using lattice PCB and you still get these divergences?
Well, I think...
I I think the short answer to that question is yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a question of whether the of what's going on in the UV of the theory at the end of the day, right? So if the answer to the real world was there's a lattice with the with the spacing of the Planck scale, for example, and you did lattice QCD on an extraordinarily large computer to simulate literally that, then there would be some lattice scale corrections that you have to take into account. So I think, I think Michael said it well. Short answer is yes.
I mean, one can amplify it a little. I mean, if the regulate, we need an ultraviolet regulator for the standard model. And if that regulator looks anything like the lattice regulator, then the hierarchy problem is a real problem.
Right.
If there's some dramatically different kind of regulator which actually makes sense, maybe we can get around it. Maybe then we'll be in the bottom right-hand corner. I don't know of any alternative that's sufficiently robust to really put us there, but that doesn't mean there's.
Right, so if you're asking about lattice versus perturbative calculations, I don't think it makes a difference. It really is a question of what is the ultraviolet physics, and does that, is there some ultraviolet physics that somehow makes the hierarchy problem go away?
When people put the Higgs theory on the lattice, there really is a you literally do have to fine tune.
So I don't think this corner of the triangle is totally preposterous. There are. There have been arguments famously, the much larger hierarchy problem we have is the cosmological constant problem. And I don't think anybody viewed it ever as an airtight argument, but Weinberg did make a sort of rough argument based on anthropic types of reasoning, namely the ability to form galaxies, predicting within a factor of 10 what the scale of the CC would be before it was found. That's, it depends a lot on what prior probabilities you assume, but, it did work. You've got to give a little bit of credit for that. There's also various sort of benevolent accidents that one can find in nuclear physics that seem like they might be disrupted by, like they would be disrupted by a larger weak bit. And again, the situation in terms of how much do you make of those is highly dependent on what priors you use, on how you, how you regulate other infinities associated with the landscape picture, if that's what you want to use. So I don't know. I think these might be hints that there's a region we would expect to find ourselves in a region with a small weak scale, even if there's no deep principled reason for it. They might be hints of that, but on the other hand, they're far away from settling the question. And on the third hand, just because it's a very unsettling conclusion about how the universe works, doesn't necessarily mean it's false. So anyway, we all live somewhere on this triangle, and I've prepared various talks and various versions of my lecture notes. Where I've used this triangle, and every single time I prepare them, I've drawn a little dot for myself, but the dot keeps moving, so I don't think I'll draw a dot today. You'll see two different dots in my notes, though, if I post them at some point. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the hierarchy problem. I want to switch gears now to just talking about supersymmetry.
Can I make one more statement?
Absolutely.
So last week I posted a little essay on TIPPH, and I think that would characterize me as being at the very top of the triangle, or as Natalia put it a couple days ago, an unreconstructed member of the previous generation.
At the very top, consistent with current data?
Yeah.
Now you have to put where you are.
All right. Where am I right now? I think.
Moving as well.
The draw.
See, okay. I think right now, my belief, like at this, at, for the next 1 minute, is that there probably is some natural-ish solution to the hierarchy problem, but that, you know, that there's probably a factor of 100 or so, fine-tuning, maybe 1,000. That, for example, Susie at 10 TeV would be totally consistent with my worldview at the minute. So that means I kind of have to buy both of these corners, so I have to start compactifying this thing in order to draw it. So I'm not sure. That's actually why I'm not drawing my dot right now. So, okay. Unless anybody else would like to add a dot.
You can put your dot and then just say that, you know, you're not committing to a linear metric.
Well, I'm not even committing to my dot. I've already made that clear. I don't know how to draw it. I mean, is that? I think that means my dot's out here. I don't know.
I don't think the approach is wrong at all. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. I don't think the approach is wrong. But I do think the likelihood of it being subject to experimental test in my lifetime is low enough that I am highly motivated to think about other questions relative to the weak hierarchy question. That is, again, yet another axis that I didn't draw. So I'm going to need the 10 dimensions of string theory before I'm done here to talk about my philosophy. I better stop. So I want to just quickly lay out both some motivations and some counterarguments for supersymmetry. Which I'll explain a little bit better in some cases later in the lecture. So, okay, one motivation is a solution to the hierarchy problem. Another is that adding superpartners. So if you ask, well, does this really favor supersymmetry in particular, or just some generic new symmetry, and one can start making aesthetic arguments about the value of different models. But more compelling than any of those aesthetic arguments is that there is one more quantitative thing that supersymmetry gets right, which is precision gauge coupling unification at about a percent level. So I think, I mean, that is another piece of substantial, roughly speaking, a prediction that succeeded pretty well. Counterarguments. Okay, one thing to watch out for is that if you had a totally generic supersymmetric theory, you would get weak scale proton decay. And that's bad. Now that's fairly easy to solve. You just need some global symmetry, approximate but very good global symmetry, to forbid it. And that's not that hard to achieve. It just tells you, it's just something to watch out for, because it does tell you something, depending on exactly what global symmetries you use, tell you something about the structure of the theory and what to look for phenomenologically. Another one is flavor physics. The that the structure of supersymmetry breaking in the MSSM has the potential to introduce large deviations in flavor physics from what's been observed, which is so far very consistent with the standard model. By which I mean, in some cases, effects about a million times larger than standard model flavor effects that have been measured. Or a million times the error bars, if you were to just be very naive about Suzy flavor. So this argues either for heavier superpartners. Or for some structure. In the super breaking. And this is the kind of thing that has also driven a lot of model building. And of course, the third is that it's not seen yet.
For half the particles.
And 100% of this evidence for symmetry has not been seen yet. And so that, of course, also points to heavier superpartners. The Higgs mass in minimal models, Higgs mass of 125 GeV, on one hand, it looks weakly coupled, and I'd actually add that to the motivation section, that there's a sort of light-ish Higgs. On the other hand, getting that lightish Higgs from a supersymmetric theory, so maybe I should also put down over here that there's a tree level prediction that the mass of the Higgs should be less than the mass of the Z. Okay, and that is obviously false. So this also argues for heavier superpartners, because then radiative corrections to the Higgs mass can be more important. By the way, this statement is really, we know what the Higgs bev is. That's been measured for a long time. So this statement that we need to raise the Higgs mass with radiative corrections, this is really a statement about increasing the Higgs quartic with the bev help fixed. No, whereas the hierarchy problem is about really the Higgs mass term in the potential. So they are different in important ways. So all of these things sort of point towards heavier superpartners if supersymmetry is correct. Solution to the hierarchy problem is, of course, best the lighter the superpartners are. This is why if you ever see a Bayesian like expectation of where, what is the allowed parameter space for supersymmetry, it is basically always right around the corner, and that is a completely invariant statement, and it tells you nothing. Because you've got constraints that are pushing it up, and you've got pressure.
There is one thing that pushes it up, not pushing it down, which is the mass of the Higgs.
Yeah. No, sorry. Yeah. I mean, all three of these actually push it up, right?
But it's not right around the corner.
Yeah.
The one thing that does not put it right around the corner is the mass of the Higgs.
Oh, it's the mass of the Higgs. That's true.
But they don't take that. I don't think they take it into account in the...
Right, and I mean there are other effects that can contribute outside the MSSM to get a heavier 125 GeV Higgs without super high partner masses.
You're not going to put dark matter on the motivation?
You're right. So if you make the right set of assumptions about the global symmetries that are saving you from proton decay, then you also have dark matter as an additional motivation. All right.
And Mariangela already explained this to us before you came.
Great.
That any of the simple hypotheses either give you an order of magnitude too much or an order of magnitude too little dark matter. So that goes on the right.
Right. All right. But I need to move on past the philosophical part of the lecture. So I've already shown you this sort of hokey numerical cancellation version of how supersymmetry solves the hierarchy problem. Now I'll show it to you upside down, because it's easier. Right, so if you have the right combination of couplings and counting of scalars and fermions, then you see that the quadratic divergences will just cancel between the scalars and the fermions. And that's a sign that that is a sign that you have the hope that you're removing this the ultraviolet sensitivity of your calculation. That by itself doesn't guarantee anything. You really need a symmetry understanding of why the Higgs mass is protected. And the way Susie addresses the Higgs mass is really that it's relating. Relates the Higgs mass to a chiral fermion mass. So it's a way that a scalar mass can be protected by a chiral symmetry, which we usually think of as not being possible. So I'll just try to give a heuristic overview of how that works, consequences for interactions, and then this afternoon talk about phenomenology. It's a symmetry with fermionic generators. So first I have to introduce a symmetry, then I have to figure out how to make a standard model invariant into that symmetry, and finally I have to break the symmetry carefully to make sure that I don't spoil its success. So I'm going to have a left-handed fermion generator and a right-handed biofermion generator, Q and Q dagger. Their commutation relations, the only one that's non-zero, is between a Q and a Q dagger. And that commutator is related to momentum. So this is really an enlargement of the space-time symmetry structure, not a global symmetry. Now, and all other commutators of Q with anything else vanish. In particular, the commutator of Q with itself vanishes, which means that Q alpha Q beta is minus Q beta Q alpha. So that has to be proportional. On any state, its action has to be proportional to epsilon alpha beta. Okay, so let's build one simple Susie representation. Let's say I start with some scalar S with momentum P, such that it's annihilated by Q dagger. And so now I can use Q to build up the rest of the representation. So this is a scalar state, one scalar. If I act with Q alpha on it, well, this is a left-handed spinner worth of states. So that's left-handed spinner, two components, right? Two degrees of freedom. And then if I acted with another Q, well, I know that has to be proportional to epsilon alpha beta times some other scalar state. just because I'm saying this is some other, I'm saying this is scalar because that's all I have the indices for. I'm saying it's a different state because I already know that if I acted with Q alpha on this, I should get zero, right? So I'd have Q alpha like with the same alpha, I'd get zero. It's the same alpha. And if I acted on this with Q alpha, I wouldn't get zero. So this has to be a distinct scalar state. So now I have another scalar. So I can combine these two together into a complex scalar field. And this one I can describe by spinner field. And this is the smallest supersymmetric representation. One complex spinner and one Weyl fermion. Now you could ask, how do I know that I couldn't choose an S such that this was actually annihilating the state? Okay, how do I know that this isn't zero? Well, the way I know that this can't be zero is by acting with Q dagger on it, right? So if I look at this commutation relation, that commutator on SP mu had better give me back P mu, right? The anti-commutator. But Q dagger annihilates this. So in other words, what I'm saying is that P mu SP is equal to that commutator, to P mu, is equal to the anti-commutator on the state, which in turn is equal to Q alpha dagger, Q alpha on this. And that's non-zero, so it had better be that Q alpha on it is not equal to zero. That's just not part of the main calculation there, though. Now, I don't remember using the board in the other order. Bring this down and write on the middle board for a second. So I want to do one more bit of counting with this. We're almost done, okay? But if we want to represent it by fields, we should make sure that all our field counting works out too, okay? So we should have, that we have equal numbers of bosonic and fermionic states at the level of the fields. So what we find is that, so I'm going to start with a scalar field phi, and then fermion psi. We can look at how many, well, we know how many real on-shell degrees of freedom this creates. This is a complex. This is a Weyl fermion. Alpha. So we know that this can create, this field will create two types of states, left-handed particle, right-handed antiparticle. Complex scalar field can create two physical states. So we have the same number of bosonic and fermionic physical states. If you were to count phase space components, so now I'm going to be looking at, say, phi, or I can think about the real part of phi, the imaginary part of phi, so that's 2, but also the conjugate momentum, real part of pi, and the imaginary part of pi. So it gives me 4 phase space components. For the Weyl fermion, I'm going to have 2 complex components of my spinner. So that's 4. But then I'll also go ahead right here, actually, since I'm doing it ahead of time, and count just real field components. So here I have 2 real field components. Here I just said I have 4 real components. You might think, oh, here I'm going to get 4 plus 4. But the reason you don't is that for a fermion, the conjugate momentum is just proportional to the field times gamma naught, and so you don't get any additional ones. It's still just the four components. So we have a balance on the physical states and on the phase space components. The data match isn't surprising, but more fermionic than scalar field components. And what that's going to signal is that in terms of physical, you know, having a symmetry between bosonic and fermionic physical states, everything is well and good. But if we wanted to continue that symmetry to our fields, we need to add something else. And so what you add is an auxiliary scalar. F. And then, by auxiliary I mean, well, no time derivatives, but more generally, just no derivatives appear in the action. And so that means there's no physical state, no phase space, but there are going to be two more field components out of that. And so in every sense, we have a balance between bosons and fermions, which is needed to realize the symmetry. All right, so what does this give us? This now tells us what the matter content needs to be. The matter content, so for every fermion of the standard model, say the top quark, we'd expect to find a scalar partner state. Okay, so this is a scalar partner for standard model fermions, and so on for all the others. For the Higgs, we expect a fermionic partner. And then I haven't done the analogous constructions for any multiplets that involve gauge bosons. But you can do them. And what you would find is that a gauge boson, let's say the gluon field, is also accompanied by one spinner field. So you have one fermionic partner for a gauge boson. And there would also be, now here in terms of degree of freedom tallying, it also works, right? A little bit differently. A gauge boson, a vial fermion still has 2 degrees of freedom. Gauge boson field is real, but this is per, I could do it for the photon, it would be easier. I wouldn't have to multiply everything by 8. The photon field, also, or each individual color of gluon field also has 2 degrees of freedom, namely the 2 plus and minus polarizations. So again, the on-shell degree of freedom counting matches up, and there's a different kind of auxiliary field that needs to be added. Now, that's the basic ingredient that you need, this sort of universal partnering, in order to allow bosonic contributions to mass terms to be canceled by fermionic contributions and vice versa. But you really need to do a bit more to see how it actually works at a Lagrangian level. So I have less time to do this than I intended. But I think what I'll do is I'll actually just go over the basic construction of a Susy Lagrangian now and talk more about the MSSM structure specifically this afternoon. So structure of a Susy Lagrangian. It's clear that we have, you know, quite a few new fields to work with now, forever, since we've just doubled the field content of the standard model. And so there's easy and hard ways of keeping track of the symmetry structure of those fields. The easy way is to think of a structure called superspace. It's maybe not surprising, since supersymmetry is an extension of space-time symmetry, that you can think about supersymmetry nicely by extending your space-time by some fermionic degrees of freedom. Okay, so some fermionic space-time coordinates. So these are Grassmann spinners coordinates. And when you do this, you can realize that supersymmetry generator in terms of basically in terms of derivatives on theta. Just like you realize momentum is ddx in space-time, you can realize q, let me get my eyes right, as a dd theta so this is that's just a spatial derivative. Okay, and when you do that, what you find is that now it's easy to write to figure out what kinds of actions would be invariant. Okay? So anything that I can write as an integral over x and theta bar, of some arbitrary function of x, theta and theta bar, that's going to be invariant because every term here is a total derivative. Now, it almost works to take a d4x d squared theta of some other function. Almost works to do this. In fact, if you look at q alpha, this is q alpha is still a total derivative. Act on, right? It's supposed to total derivatives in theta, total derivatives in x. So this would still be invariant under Q. But it's not generically invariant under Q dot, under Q dagger. Okay? So to make this actually invariant under Q dagger, it has to satisfy an additional condition, which is that D, a new operator, D dagger, acting on W, has to equal zero. And D alpha is basically, it's like Q alpha, but with a sign reversed. So d dagger, again, I'll just make sure I get this right to define it, but we're not going to be using this very much. So dd theta dagger plus I theta alpha dot W. So that motivates you to try to build fields that are annihilated by D dagger. And if you try to build a field that's annihilated by D dagger, you'll actually get precisely a field that has these three components in it. Okay, so you can build a field that's annihilated by D dagger, and it'll have, well actually the simplest way to write it is in terms of a new variable y. This is the only problem with superspace, is that you have to define like 10 variables at the very beginning. And then once you've defined all these different variables, you can write everything very simply. But it's just one definition after another until you get there. Where y is x plus the shift term built out of thetas. I guess actually that's the way it's usually written. Okay. With an I. So so here you see our familiar, our three fields that I was talking about earlier. Now, to actually get from this action written this way to an action you're familiar with, what you need to do is, actually there's one more thing I should say first, just some power counting. So Q alpha we know should have mass dimension 1/2, right? Because two Q alphas is gonna give you mass dimension and momentum. That means that dd theta has to have mass dimension 1/2. And that theta has to have mass dimension minus 1/2. An integral d theta, because this is Grossmann, integrals are just like derivatives. So integrals, this integral also has dimension 1. This has dimension 1, which means that whatever this k is has to have mass dimension 2. And w has to have mass dimension 3. And these fields, if I say phi has mass dimension 1, psi has mass dimension 3 halves, f has mass dimension 2. Now if I wanted to, well now you see that there's already a sort of the structure, the ingredients you need for chiral symmetry here, right? So if I had a global symmetry under which this field phi had charge 1, and that's the only field in my Lagrangian, simplest possible theory. One field, charge 1 under global symmetry. I can never make a symmetry invariant W here, because I'm only, W has to be annihilated by this D dagger. Phi is annihilated by D dagger, but phi dagger isn't. Phi dagger is annihilated by D. So in order to build a W that's annihilated by D dagger, all I can do is products of these fields without their conjugates. So you have a chiral structure there, even though you're only talking about, even when you're talking about scalar fields. So the only Lagrangian, the only renormalizable Lagrangian for a charged phi would be that your action has to take this form of just, you can have things like phi star phi, that has the right mass dimension, and then you could have non-renormalizable corrections if you want. But that's it. W equals 0 for a charge, single charged field phi. And it turns out that with this W piece forbidden, you're guaranteed to get no mass terms. Okay, so you can this kind of looks like a mass term if you're used to scalar field theories. But remember that this d squared theta bar forces me to take pieces in the expansion of phi that have thetas in them. I can get thetas from here. Then I'm not talking about phi, I'm talking about f. So this isn't giving me a mass. I can also get thetas from the expansion of y, but those are always going to come, if I imagine plugging in that y, and pulling out thetas from the expansion of phi, then that's going to give me derivatives with respect to x if I'm doing a Taylor expansion. Another way to see that is just, there's no way this could give me a mass term because there's no dimensionful coupling in it. Right? So I know this is the simplest example where you have a scalar field in supersymmetry whose mass is protected by a chiral symmetry. And the simple way of thinking about that is the fact that it's related by Suzy to a fermion, and we already know that charged fermion masses are protected by chiral symmetries. All right. You can use this formalism to. Let me just say a word now about breaking supersymmetry. So I'll save the MSSM details for the afternoon, but say a word about breaking it. We can think about this in the context of a toy model. But we know that, one thing I haven't shown you, but that I hope you'll believe for now, is that any supersymmetric Lagrangian, these partner particles, scalar and fermionic partners, have exactly degenerate masses. And because they have exactly degenerate masses, that's not very, this partner setup isn't very consistent with what we've seen in nature. So we have to be talking about broken supersymmetry. And if we break the symmetry, we want to break it in a way that preserves the nice ultraviolet properties. So that means you want to do what's called breaking it softly. The simple way to think about that is just that you want to break it by dimensionful parameters. The picture, the rationale being that you're trying to preserve the ultraviolet behavior of the theory. If you were to change, say, a coupling, a quartic coupling of the scalar relative to the fermionic coupling, then you know that would spoil the UV behavior, right? Because we had this cancellation that was of divergent terms that were proportional to the coupling. But if you just have a mass parameter, then you expected the high momentum part of your loop integrals, that mass parameter is going to become irrelevant. So this should be irrelevant to the UV cancellations that motivated us. The second way of thinking about this soft breaking, which is a little more refined, is that you really want to imagine that you have some spurion for spontaneous Susie breaking elsewhere. So what I mean by that is that, for example, there's some sector that breaks supersymmetry, and the result of that might be that there's some field X that gets an expectation value that has some thetas in it. Okay, so both the F component and the scalar component of X could get expectation values. Since they're both scalars, that preserves Lorentz invariance. But that then is not invariant under the supersymmetry generator, under Q. That's easy to see. So in this case, then you can plug those VEVs into the same kind of construction and get mass terms from it. So for example, if I take my little toy scalar example there, my toy scalar action, I could imagine adding, instead we could add non-renormalizable terms. An X dagger X. Phi dagger phi with a 1 over M squared. And now you see, now this here it's simple enough that I'm just going to do out the theta expansions on the board. I can pull out the theta squared term from the expectation value of x, and that cancels this integral. Similarly for the theta bars from the expectation value of x star, right? In other words, this contains a theta squared, theta bar squared, fx mod squared. And these integrals are really just like derivatives, right? So they're just pulling out the terms with two theta bars. So this is going to give me precisely fx squared over m squared times the components of phi without any thetas. The component of phi without any thetas was just the scalar field phi of x mod squared. So that is a mass term for my scalar field that I can get from supersymmetry breaking. So I think I should stop there. If you guys have any questions about this, I'll get to the more phenomenological
maybe
side.
Maybe it would be good to write the general Lagrangian component here.
Okay. Does anybody have questions about other stuff before I do that? I think I agree.
What's some physical intuition for this auxiliary scalar that you introduced?
Well, so the only intuition I can give is in terms of what effects it has.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so I'll give you an answer in two parts. The first is what Michael suggested, and the second is maybe a diagrammatic one. Remember, this auxiliary scalar has no dynamics, right? No derivatives, so you're never going to produce any particles associated with it. But it'll play a role in getting the interaction, the structure of the interactions out from the Lagrangian. So let's say that I had a more generic set of fields. So I have some. So if I had a bunch of fields, I mean, the only renormalizable thing I can ever write down for this first term, the K term, is just things in the form phi star phi for different fields. And it turns out, I could have just said this, when you expand this out in terms of components, the K term is just going to give you kinetic terms for phi, kinetic term for psi, and then an F star F. Okay. That's all you ever get out of it. For a bunch of fields, let's say you have more than one charged field, or you have neutral fields, so you can build more general combinations. Then the most general W that you could think of would be one with, so if you have uncharged fields, you can have some linear terms, mass dimension 2. I can have bilinear terms, and I can have trilinear terms. And that's the most general possibility. When I ask what potential I get from this, wait, so these will have the effect of basically just a tadpole for singlets. And but let me for now assume that we don't have singlets and not include them. So then we just have these M terms and these terms. Now, you can get the fermion interactions by just taking two superfields and taking the fermionic pieces of them. And that you can sort of read off from the decomposition of phi up there. So for example, for the fermion interactions from this superpotential, W is called a superpotential, sorry, you would get Mij over 2 psi I psi j. And then you would get things that look like lambda ijk scalar term with two fermions. Okay, so this, for example, this is a Yukawa coupling. If I take the superfields containing the Higgs up quark and right-handed down quarks, I put in my up-type Yukawa couplings as one example, this kind of trilinear interaction, then that will give me a Yukawa coupling of the Higgs to the quark, to the up-type quarks. It'll also give me, though, a coupling of the Higgs fermionic partner to a quark and a scalar partner of a quark, right? So it'll give all combinations of these. For scalars, what you end up getting is a potential that's just the sum over all the different fields of the derivative of W with respect to phi squared. And this is coming from those auxiliary pieces. So if I were to expand this out into components, what I would find is, for example, I'll just focus on the Mij term. I would have also found that my Lagrangian contains Mij phi I Fj. But it also had these F squared terms. And so when you complete the square, you can, or in other words, integrating out, it's often referred to as integrating out F, what you would find is that, and this Mij over phi I, that's precisely this derivative. What you would get is, so that's an F minus F plus Mij phi I. Fj. I'm sorry, this is more confusing when I do it with the indices. I should again take a specific example. Okay, let's say I just have one with charge 1 and one with charge minus 1, so I'm just going to call them phi plus and f minus. I'd also have an f plus squared. Of course, I'm also going to have a phi minus f plus term and an f minus squared. I'm just not writing those down. So I can write this as an f plus m phi, I'm sorry, f minus plus m phi plus squared. Over 4 minus except that somehow I made an embarrassing factor 2 mistake, so that this math doesn't actually work. Can you tell what I'm doing wrong?
Yeah, there shouldn't be a factor 2 in the first term.
On the math term. Very good. Thank you.
There shouldn't be any factor.
There shouldn't be any factor of 2. Very good. And so this would also, right, and this is the absolute value squared. As is this one. Okay, sorry about that. And so then this is just some combination that we can ignore because it has I can, you know, call that, do a change of variables, call this F tilde. It's just some completely irrelevant field that does nothing anymore once I've completed the squares. And what I would be left with is a mass term. Is a mass term for the scalars, which matches the mass term that I would have gotten for the fermions if I had been consistent with my factor of 2 from the beginning. So I mentioned there is sort of a diagrammatic way of thinking about what the auxiliary fields are doing. And what that is to think, well, all of these diagrams here are related by raising one. If I think of acting with Q on a state as raising it, raising one field and lowering the other at the same time gives me one of the related supersymmetry related interactions. So here, to get from this to this, I raised the Higgs field and lowered the up field, giving me back my scalar component. I could do that again, raising the Higgs and lowering the quark. And that, the Higgsino and lowering the quark, and that would give me back to this F. That would give me an interaction of this F field for the Higgsino with the quark. With the left-handed and right-handed quarks. And now you can think about these Fs as something that you can just sort of mirror that to get an interaction with physical fields. integrating out the f's, because I mean, there's, in other words, there's never going to be any dynamics from the f's, right? You're never going to get external. There's no state, so you're never going to care about external lines, but they can still connect to one another. And what that does is it just induces these quartic interactions. In fact, I chose this example badly, because had I done my raising and lowering on any one of these other lines instead of on the Higgs, I would have gotten one of the Higgs stop quartic couplings that I introduced at the very beginning of the lecture. And so this precisely relating the quartic, so of course, I could have done this procedure to any one of the lines. In other words, I'm really taking the sum of all derivatives of that superpotential back to different scalars. So I'm not just going to get this type of quartic, I'm also going to get quartics involving the quarks and the Higgs fields. And those are the ones that I can sew up and precisely get contributions that cancel the top quadratic divergence. Itai.
Well, maybe you can comment if you disagree, but I think one example that is completely unmysterious to you is the vector potential. The zeros component of A mu is not propagating, doesn't have any dynamics. You can get rid of it entirely. It's a bit different than F because it actually has a gradient term, but that's not
right.
That's still not dynamical. But in the same way, you can think about the Coulomb law as exactly this sort of four-point function.
Yeah, no, that's very good. Thank you, Itai. So the difference, of course, is that A0 is not Lorentz invariant, and so we often work very hard to write, you know, to keep the non-dynamical field in our theory in order to preserve Lorentz invariants. Here I can integrate it out and preserve Lorentz invariants, but it's really quite analogous because in order to write it in a way that's manifestly supersymmetric, I need to keep it in. If I don't care, if I only want to write down something Lorentz invariant, I don't care about supersymmetry, then I can integrate it out. And I'll just get all of these interactions, just like gauge theory. The theory is still supersymmetric, right? Gauge theory is still a Lorentz invariant theory when you integrate out A0. When you integrate out F, the theory is still supersymmetric. It's just not as manifest anymore. And so you put in F in order to keep the supersymmetry manifest in how you write down all the interactions of the theory. That's a very good analogy. Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question about the mass dimension counting. I'm a little confused. If the Q alpha is the dimension half, the C thing should be negative half because it's in denominator.
Sorry, which one are you pointing to?
That mass dimension counting of Q generator mass dimension counting.
Sorry, I think I...
That's correct.
Theta, yeah. What? I agree with you. Yes, I wrote unclearly. So what you said is correct. This operator here, dd theta, should have dimension 1/2. Theta itself has dimension minus 1/2.
So
that's what you were saying.
Next line.
So the next line.
All the way up the left.
Yeah.
It should be minus 1.
For d theta.
Yeah.
Well, the way I always think about it is that integrals are.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, because it's Grassmann. This is very confusing, but. I should really think of an integral d theta for a Grassmann variable as being exactly the same as the derivative with respect to theta, and precisely the opposite, right? It precisely eats a theta, just like a derivative does. And so that's why it has, so that's why I have for each integral d theta, just like for each derivative with respect to theta, a plus 1/2.
I think the mass dimension counting is well defined because if you integrate a constant equal to zero, right? Integrate theta over a constant equal to zero, the zero is dimension zero. But in left hand, you get dimension one. That is
zero can be whatever mass dimension is convenient, right? So while I agree that it's a little bit sketchy because, you know.
Well, the thing that matters is what,
yeah, but,
how do you get pure numbers? You get pure
right.
numbers by acting on that thing.
Yeah. That is the invariant question, right? Is how when you get something that's non-zero, what dimension is it? Or how do you get pure numbers? I mean, the mass dimension of zero is really whatever is convenient at the time, right? Because zero g is equal to 0 centimeters. I think. but if you prefer, you could just be much happier by thinking about this not as an integral but as a derivative. And then, you know, if I didn't call them integrals, you would never disagree with me, right? And the integral and the derivative for a Grassmann variable are completely equivalent.
Anyway, if you roll up the blackboard.
Yeah.
A little more.
You want.
The kinetic term that's written there is obviously the right one. So
yeah.
That should set the word.
Okay, we should probably go to the next lecture because it's 10:30. But if there are any other, I mean, supersymmetry is a big subject, and Rafael does have another lecture or two today. So if there are any quick questions, we can still do it.
Yeah.
Any conceptual issues? Right.
Yeah, maybe I can also start with questions on in the afternoon.
Yeah, so I think that's a good idea.
I think
it's a very good idea to try to go over the lecture notes before the next lecture too, and just make sure that you have some idea of what's happening. If you have any questions, I mean, this is so fundamental to much of the thinking that is going on in the Onostan model that. I think it's worth actually investing some time. So with that, let's move to cosmology and thank Natalia.